Good afternoon, everybody. Hey, I'm Ann Eller, and we are very privileged today to have Senator Shane Massie on the air with us this afternoon. He is, I believe, probably calling in from Columbia down there, and he is also the Senate Majority Leader. How you doing today, Shane?
Hey, Ann, I'm doing great. How are you?
Very good. Hey, exciting news that Mick Mulvaney got confirmed today.
That is great news, isn't it? It's nice to see South Carolinians taking on major positions, and that's a big one. That's actually probably one of the most powerful positions in federal government, having that kind of influence over the budget, and having somebody like Mick in that position is a big deal. So I'm very proud of him.
I think it's great, and I think you couldn't have put a better person in that from the day he got up there. That was his issue, and he kept talking about the size and scope of government. So, yeah, I think he'll do a great job, and he'll probably butt heads with the president, too.
I think he'll probably butt heads with a lot of people over spending practices. But, you know, Mick served in the South Carolina Senate with me for a couple years before he was elected to Congress. And he is definitely a numbers guy. He understands budgets. I think he's going to be tremendous in that role.
I couldn't agree with you more. And, of course, down here in South Carolina, we do have our own issues. I happened to see that today you were handing out, y'all voted on harsher penalties for hiring a prostitute today.
Yeah, that's true. We've been, we've actually... been dealing with this for the last couple weeks, but the idea is we're trying to stiffen the penalties for those who are soliciting prostitutes because we've got a growing problem in South Carolina, unfortunately, of younger girls being lured into sex trafficking and prostitution, and so we're trying to up the penalties for people who are soliciting those young girls in order to try to stop it.
Sure. Well, it gets pretty stiff. It starts out with a $200, goes to $1,000, I think, and then from $1,000 that it was to $3,000, and then goes up from there.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. It is what you just said. I mean, we're trying to stiffen the penalties, trying to send a message, and hopefully we can stop this.
Yeah. But I just thought that was an interesting one, and of course the state had great headlines on that today.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, I just read that headline, the article that the state wrote, and it's good to get some publicity on that because I think this is probably one of those things that a lot of people just aren't aware of. But the sex trafficking, especially with younger girls, has been a growing concern, and this is just really the latest effort to try to slow it down.
It is hard to believe here in South Carolina. If we were in New York City or something like that, you might believe that it was a big issue.
That's right. You know, and lots of times, even when people are aware of the situation, they think that it may be some foreign girls who are brought in or some illegals who have been smuggled into the country and, you know, they've been used for that. But more and more, Ann, what we're seeing are these are South Carolina girls. These are young girls who have run away from home, or they have drug addiction problems, or in many cases they have some significant mental issues that are leading to them, making them vulnerable to be lured into this whole area.
Sure. And of course, we've got real issues, too, with the department that takes care of our youth and the runaways and everything. That's been a real issue this time, too, isn't it?
Yeah, so we've been dealing with the Department of Social Services for the last probably 3 or 4 years, some pretty intense scrutiny that they've been getting, and, I mean, let's face it, they've earned it. But they're... We have a subcommittee in the Senate that has been conducting oversight hearings on a regular basis with the Department of Social Services. And I really do think it's important to recognize that they've made some significant improvements over there. Things are getting better. Their caseloads are getting better. But there are still issues we need to be working on. And I'm pleased with the leadership we have over at DSS now, but we still got a long ways to go.
Yeah, I think I've heard that, and you know, it just seems to me that a lot of oversight, it seems to be the problem that South Carolina deals with, whether it's in social services, SCDOT, the pension plan. I mean, we have issues here in South Carolina, Shane.
Well, that's a great point. So I'll tell you, the oversight that the General Assembly has conducted historically has been reactive, right? It has been in response to some type of a crisis, some type of terrible event that's gone on, and we've done oversight in response to that. And DSS is a good example of that. You mentioned the pension system. I mean, that's an example. A few years ago with issues that we had at the Department of Health and Human Services, we did a good bit of oversight following significant deficits. We've still been conducting some oversight of the Department of Employment and Workforce, which has made tremendous improvements over where they were just a few years ago. That's just a good example of leadership really does matter. But one of the things that a few of us have really been pushing for the last 4 or 5 years is for the General Assembly to conduct oversight of executive agencies on a regular basis, to try to be more proactive on that and to try to stop some of these problems before they get out of hand, so that if we can find out about some little things, hopefully we can stop them from becoming big things. And so far, that does seem to be working to some extent. But the House of Representatives has joined in. They've been doing a good bit of oversight. We've got some oversight work going on in the Senate as well. This is actually one of the few things that I think Washington does right. They have oversight hearings all the time. And I think it's important that people know you're looking over their shoulder.
Sure.
It's important for the General Assembly to be educated on what's going on in the executive agencies, because you're absolutely right. I mean, you nailed it. Most of our oversight has been reactive. We've got to do a better job of being proactive.
Well, in the business world, I learned a long time ago, people don't do what you expect, only what you inspect. And it's very, very true. Unfortunately, it's very true.
Well, it's important, and probably for all of us, actually, to know that you've got somebody looking over your shoulder.
Yep.
And I think that, you know, most of the problems that we've had have not been because of intentional wrongdoing. Some of it may have been some competency issues in some areas. Some of it's probably just been laziness, mm-hmm. In certain areas that have led to some problems. And in some cases, it's just good people have made wrong decisions.
Sure.
But in any event, you still need to have folks looking over your shoulder to inspect, as you said.
Right.
And the other part of that is it's important for legislators to understand what's going on in these agencies, to make sure that they're following through with their statutory mandates and to make sure they're not getting out of line. And I think that's just as important, that we be able to understand everything that's happening here.
Well, I think that that's where some of the budgeting issues have come down, because it hasn't been on point as to what was actually needed and where it was needed.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's exactly the case, because historically, the only regular review that most of the agencies have received from the legislative branch has been during the budget process. Wherein, you know, each agency will come before the House Ways and Means Committee and the Senate Finance Committee when they're making their budget requests. But those reviews are really not very substantive most of the time. It's just kind of a cursory look at how things are going, and very rarely do you talk about anything other than, all right, here's where you were last year. Do we need to increase it over that? How much do we need to increase it? There's not been a very thorough vetting of the programs, of how they've been spending the money, and we're trying to change that some. But look, this is really a culture change from the General Assembly. It's going to require some people to do a whole lot more work than they're used to doing, which is not a bad thing. But we're getting there. It's a slow process, but it really is a culture change, so that doesn't happen overnight.
Well, and didn't I just read that Governor McMaster is saying that there needs to be some belt tightening down there in Columbia.
Yeah, I read that too. I mean, you know, Governor McMaster has had the benefit of being able to preside over the Senate for the last couple of years, so he's had an ability to observe a lot of the major issues that have been debated, and just to stand there and just listen, and that's something that a lot of people don't have the opportunity to do. So he's heard both sides of the debate on lots of these issues already. He's been through a couple different budget debates, so he's got some pretty good ideas. He's got some good insight into how some things have been working, and you know, I think what he's been saying is that for the most part across state government, that the issue is more of a spending problem than it is a revenue problem.
Sure, and you know, when we talk about, well, let's just talk about the roads a little bit. That's been a hot issue for the last 3 or 4 years, particularly last year, and now
Right. We're
into this year. I think the feeling was that a gas tax might be in order, but so far the governor, McMaster, is saying that that would be a last resort. What are you thinking, Shane, on this?
Yeah, I mean, that's what the governor has told me as well, and some other folks, and I understand that. I mean, I think it should be a last resort. I think any type of additional revenue, anytime you're asking the public to pay more for something, that really ought to be a last resort, right? I mean, you shouldn't be asking for money unless if you can find it somewhere else. So I agree with the governor on that. Now, having said that, I think if you look around at how the DOT has been funded, and you look at what their funding levels are and the work that needs to be done, I think you can make a case that we're getting close to that last resort.
Sure.
But I think there's still a good bit of discussion that needs to be had on that.
So do you think that are there any conditions that the Senate will go for the gas tax and the other vehicle fees to be increased? Would that be an option before the end of the session?
I think it depends on what else is with it. That's my impression. There have been a couple different proposals out there. There's a proposal in the House of Representatives that's passed the committee. It's on the House floor now. It's just a proposal for additional revenue. Our Democratic friends in the Senate introduced something earlier this week that's along the same lines. It's just a tax increase. I don't think either one of those proposals is going to fare very well in the Senate. I just don't think that you're going to get a straight-up tax increase out of the Senate. There's going to be too much opposition to that. There's going to have to be, I think, some type of offsets, some type of tax reform in other areas to make that palatable for a lot of us.
Well, such as what type of tax reform? Because Governor Haley said that last year, and nothing happened.
Well, yes.
Well, that's
so
right.
Governor Haley did talk about that.
Yeah.
She talked about primarily the individual income tax rates.
Right.
There are some issues there where our rates, at least on the surface, are higher than our neighbors. Well, that's not a situation you want to be in. Now, effectively, our income tax rates aren't as high as they look. But that is an issue that we have to deal with. I think what we need to do, and this is something that some of us in the Senate Republican caucus have been talking about, is trying to come up with some reform ideas that will help the working class. We want to help middle-class taxpayers, parents, and especially parents of college students. We want to try to help some of the lower-income folks as well. But if we can try to spread this out some so that you're providing some changes to some of our tax structures, I think we can make some progress on that. I'll give you one specific example.
I'm waiting.
Okay. South Carolina has one of the highest industrial taxes in the country. We're at 10.5%. So if you've got a small business, let's say it's a construction business, all right, you're paying 10.5% on all your equipment, your ladders, your machinery, your trucks, and that's a pretty high rate. Okay. Now, if you're a big company like Boeing, you're going to be able to negotiate with local government for a fee in lieu. You're going to pay less than 10.5%. The smaller guys don't have that ability. They don't have that negotiation leverage. And that's actually a deterrent for a lot of smaller businesses. I mean, it's a really competitive disadvantage that we're putting them in. So one of the things that we're looking at is trying to give some relief to those folks, because that's still where most of our folks are working, are in smaller businesses. I mean, the Boeings and Michelins and those large companies are getting a lot of the attention, and, deservedly so. They're doing great work. I'm glad they're here. But still, more South Carolinians are employed by smaller businesses.
You're absolutely right.
And so we need to try to take care of those folks and to try to put them on a competitive playing field. So that's one of the things we're looking at. We're looking at a little bit with individual income tax rates, but I think, and this is surprising some of our Democratic friends, but we're going to introduce the earned income tax credit for the first time to try to help pull some people out of poverty and reward work. That's one of the big things we want to do. We want to reward people who are working to try to encourage work. So I think there are lots of different ideas we have on the table to try to do some tax reform, but also get some tax relief in that same package. And if we can include some of those things in with gas tax discussions, if we can continue talking about reform at the Department of Transportation, I think there's a real chance that we can get something done. And I'm more optimistic this year than I've been in years past.
You're more optimistic. How come we don't go ahead? Sorry, Shane. How come we don't go ahead and just redo the tax code, the whole tax code? You know, we've been talking about it for years, and it's never gotten done.
Yeah. Everybody's always talking about comprehensive tax reform, and there's no question that it needs to be done. I think the reason that it hasn't been done is just that it's hard. When you start dealing with one section of the tax code, you're going to pick up some opponents. Well, you try to alleviate that and go to a different section, you've got some different opponents. It's not that people don't care, it's just that it's hard. It's very difficult to do all those big things. It's hard to get enough people to agree. Enough legislators to agree on one particular fix, which is why you really almost have to start off with smaller levels, take smaller bites at it.
Well, I've heard our tax system here described as a hose that keeps being repaired, and eventually it just leaks and you repair it again. So that's why I just wonder. And every time it's brought up, it's because somebody's up for re-election. That's why they haven't wanted to do it.
But yeah, I mean, that's when you typically hear the discussion.
Yeah.
But there have been, there have been, especially over the last few years, there have been, 8, 10, 12 of us in the Senate who've been trying to expand the conversation beyond just the gas tax to talk about some of these other tax reform ideas that everybody recognizes that we need to do. And so that's what we're trying to put forth, is to try to deal with some of these things. And the industrial tax, that 10.5% is one of the big ones.
Well,
I hope we can get there.
How about some of the fees that were put forth there? Would there be a possibility, if they didn't go for the gas tax, would they go for some of these fees? Like, for example, registering if you buy a car, instead of a flat $300, that it would be based on the price of the car?
Right, so you're talking about the sales tax on vehicles,
because
right now it is, the sales tax on vehicles, personal property really, so it applies to boats, it applies to airplanes, but mostly we're talking about our cars. But the sales tax is 6% of the purchase price, but it's capped at $300.
Correct.
Which means that it's almost always $300.
Right.
So there has been some discussion about increasing that amount, but probably still have a cap on it. But if you increase it a little bit, you're going to get some revenue out of that. And as you mentioned, you know, there are lots of some of the proposals, especially in the House plan, have talked about increasing all sorts of different fees in conjunction with their gas act proposal. They're looking at increasing driver's license registration fees and
Well, how do you feel about that?
I'm sorry?
How do you feel about that, about increasing fees?
Well, you know, what I hear from people more often is that they dislike those things more than anything else, right? I mean, they really don't like having to pay more for driver's licenses and things like that.
Yeah.
But what it does do, though, is it spreads out the burden. So you don't just have a few people paying, and you're not getting all your money from one source. And I do think that's important because, and this gets into a larger tax reform discussion too, and that is, I think from a philosophical perspective, I believe if you got to have a tax on something, I think it ought to be a tax where you have more people paying less as opposed to fewer people paying more, right? I mean, I want to spread the burden. I want everybody to have some skin in the game. I want everybody to contribute. Whereas what we have gotten to is a smaller, dwindling pool of people who are paying more of the burden. And philosophically, I've got real problems with that. And so I like the idea of spreading it out so that everybody can contribute a little as opposed to a few paying a lot. And then you also, by doing that, it's a much more stable source of revenue because you've got a few different things that are contributing as opposed to just relying on one. So I'm open to that general idea of spreading these things out because I think that's going to make a stronger, it's going to make for a stronger economic environment.
Well, isn't the gas tax one that spreads it out for those that use it versus those that don't?
It does. I mean, that's definitely true. I mean, look, anybody who's paid attention to my record in the Senate and how I voted on things, I mean, it's, as my wife says, I'm cheap. This is the beginning of my 10th year, so I voted on 9 budgets, and I voted against the budget 7 out of 9 years because I think we don't prioritize very well or we spend too much money. With that being said, if I've got to have a tax, my preference is that it be a consumption tax, mm-hmm. right, as opposed to an income tax or
sure.
a tax on property. I like consumption tax better than those other alternatives because everybody has to contribute. And that is a benefit of the gas tax is you get everybody contributing, but even better than that, you get, by every credible estimate that I've seen, probably 30% of that revenue is coming from non-residents.
Right, people coming to
Whereas what we have been doing the last 2 or 3 years is we've been using some surplus revenue that has been coming almost exclusively from income tax collections
right.
To fund different road projects. And philosophically, I don't like that. I don't think that's a good approach. You're leaving a lot of out-of-state money on the table, and you're not even asking everyone who uses the roads to contribute to their maintenance. So I've got real problems with that. But, I mean, so generally speaking, I like consumption taxes, and the gas tax is one of them.
Sure. Well, it just seems since we already have the lowest gas tax, and that we have the second largest road system, and that we've got to figure out a way to fix these roads. Didn't Christy Hall say that it was going to take $1 billion a year to bring
yeah.
those roads back up?
Yeah, so we do have the lowest gas tax in the country, which, a lot of people are using that as an argument that we should increase it because of that. The fact that we have the lowest isn't a reason for me to increase it.
Right.
There's got to be a much better reason than that. But, yeah, I mean, I've spent a good bit of time in the last couple of years looking at the DOT stuff. And, you know, with the background of me being cheap again, I'll tell you, I don't know how you look at it and come away with the conclusion anything other than the Department of Transportation needs more money to do what we all expect the Department of Transportation to do.
Right.
Now, we can talk about how you get that money, whether we're using existing income tax collections, whether you're talking about increasing the gas tax or whatever else. We can talk about the ways you arrive at that, but I don't think there's an objective conclusion to be reached other than DOT doesn't have the funds to do what we all expect them to do. Now, I am very pleased with Christy Hall. That is probably the most significant reform that we could have made, is putting Christy Hall in charge of that agency. She is a strong leader. She knows what she's doing. She has implemented a significant number of reforms that she doesn't get any credit for because they haven't been publicized. Christy is doing a very good job over there, and I think things are improving, but the reality is they can't do what we all expect them to do.
Correct.
If they fired every employee that they have, they wouldn't have nearly enough money to do all that we expect them to do. I mean, it's just the reality, and it hurts me to say that because I'm cheap. but it's the truth. So, yeah.
So, do you think that this year that they will make a stand on that the governor and the House and the Senate can come together and make a plan for not just this coming year, but for futuristically to get our roads back up to snuff?
I do. I really do. I mean,
you're being recorded, you know, Shane. I'm recording this right now.
Yes, ma'am. I understand. So I expect that in a few months we're going to come back and talk about this, and it's either going to be you telling me that I was crazy, or we're going to be celebrating a significant accomplishment.
Exactly.
But I really am. I mean, standing here today on February 16th?
Yes.
I'm actually optimistic. I'm not saying it's going to be easy, because still, this is the most divisive issue that we've had to deal with since I've been in the Senate. And so there are still issues that we've got to deal with. There are still challenges we've got to overcome. But I really do think that we're going to get it done this year. And when I say get it done, I mean a long-term solution to the problem. And quite candidly, if we don't, then people ought to be upset with us.
All right. Well, we heard it right here. Now, just I would like to hear that there's a plan, because it just keeps coming up and we never seem to solve it. And then next year, and there's $446 million
right.
Extra dollars, and yet are we going to have those extra dollars to put to all the things that they're talking about spending money on? But one of
right.
the things that interested me was Governor McMaster asked President Donald Trump, for $5.2 billion. Do you think when he comes on Friday to see Boeing, he'll be bringing a check?
Yeah, there's been some joking about that. Maybe he's just going to bring the checkbook with him. I think what the governor was going after there is that the president's been talking a good bit, even during the campaign, talked about a major spending bill for infrastructure across the country. And he
right.
talked about like $1 trillion, I think. And so the governor was asking for $5 billion out of the trillion for South Carolina projects. And now I don't know how likely that is with what's going on in Washington. I'd be very surprised if the United States House of Representatives passes a $1 trillion spending plan on anything.
Right.
But look, South Carolina has been for quite some time and still is a donor state, which means we pay more in federal gas taxes than we receive back from the federal government.
Sure.
Now, it's much closer now than where it used to be. I think we're paying, or we get back like 96 cents or something like that for every dollar we pay, somewhere around that neighborhood, I think.
Sure.
But you know, we also have to maintain a lot of federal roadways, interstate highways, U.S. highways.
Well,
it makes sense to have some federal contribution. And, you know, Governor McMaster is certainly friendly with the president, so put in the request. All he can do is say no, I guess.
Well, I think that's great. Now, are you going to be down there to meet the president on Friday?
Yes, ma'am. I'm going down tomorrow morning. So the folks from Boeing called me yesterday and asked me if I could come down, and that's one of those things where you say, yes, sir, you tell me when to be there.
Absolutely.
So I'm excited about that. I'm excited about that for many reasons. I mean, the president's going to be in town, so it's a good opportunity to show South Carolina to the president. I think that's great. But beyond that, this is really an exciting time for Boeing, especially with the union vote yesterday and the rollout tomorrow of the newest edition of the Dreamliner, which is all made in North Charleston. These are all made in North Charleston, the 787-10. That's a great accomplishment for us. It's a great accomplishment for Boeing, so I'm happy to be part of it.
Absolutely. I just wondered if the president coming down on Friday and they had the vote yesterday, if there was any, if his coming down might have swayed the vote any against the unions.
I don't know that that really had a big impact on the vote outcome.
Right.
I think they had a pretty good idea how the vote was going to turn out. They probably didn't know. I think Boeing was confident they were going to win.
Yes.
They didn't know what the outcome was going to be. They probably would not have guessed they were going to win 74% of the vote.
Yeah.
But that was a big statement, and I think probably because they were confident that they were going to be successful, that probably helped the president make the decision to come. He probably wouldn't have wanted to come if they were going to lose.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. But, you know, so you know, we don't get anything from the media market in Charleston, but my understanding is that both sides have been on television, they've been on the radio. I mean, it's been like a regular political campaign, spending millions of dollars, and there were only like 3,000 people who were eligible to vote.
Yeah.
But it's a big deal. I mean, you know, we should not underestimate that. I mean, that sends a powerful message across the country about South Carolina's business environment.
I think it sends a huge
74% is a strong number.
I think it says a huge number, Shane.
Yeah.
Huge.
It's a statement. It's definitely a statement. And, I mean, look, if that vote had gone the other way, you better believe that the unions would have been playing this up all over the country.
Absolutely.
And I think we ought to play it up as well to show our commitment to a strong business environment, because it's a strong statement. It's a huge number, as you said.
Absolutely. Now, also, I'd be curious about the internet sales tax bill that passed this week. And, of course, that's going to basically enforce state sales tax for items bought online. Wouldn't it be bigger tax impact on South Carolinians than the gas tax increase that everybody is so upset about, and yet this tax has gone through here?
Well, so what we passed in the Senate, really, it shouldn't increase taxes at all. It's as you said, it's just the enforcement of current law.
Right.
And then if Congress were ever to change the law to allow for more sales tax collections online, then it could have an impact, but I don't see that happening. Well, what this is really is you've got a requirement in South Carolina law now to pay sales taxes on things that you buy online. And for those who are actually following the law, they're at a disadvantage because they're doing the right thing. Whereas you've got some people who are skirting the law and by not paying their use tax. And this is just really an attempt to enforce that existing law. So there's no additional taxes that were imposed, just the enforcement of existing law.
But that should impact the dollars coming into the coffers of South Carolina.
Well, what we were told by the economic analysis and analysts is they didn't tell us that there would be an impact. Now, I think realistically there will be because you're going to have people paying who should have been paying all along.
Sure.
We'll have to see what that is. But I don't know. I mean, you know, it's difficult for me to defend people who have deliberately not been complying with the law when there are a lot of the rest of us who have been.
Absolutely. And now I want to ask if you have just a few minutes to talk about the pension system for South Carolina. You know, you're hearing all different sides of this, and of course, State Treasurer Curtis Loftus has been all over this issue. Where do you stand on this, Shane? Is this, at number one, as drastic a problem? Are they actually looking at closing the pension system and the effect that it'll have on communities if they do that?
So I think it's a very significant problem, and I think it is also a very complicated problem, mm-hmm. and it's so complicated that in many cases when you start talking about it, people's eyes glaze over.
Well, not on the radio, Shane.
Yeah, well, let's hope not, especially if they're driving.
Exactly.
But it is a long-term problem. I mean, look, we didn't get into this problem overnight, and it's not something that we're going to get out of overnight. But there are several things that have contributed to the problem we're in, I think. Well, one of those is we chose to get into the equities market at probably the worst time since 1929. We passed a constitutional amendment to allow for that, because it used to be that our pension system was invested solely in bonds. And I think in 2004, 2006, we amended our constitution to allow for investment in equities. Well, when they got in, it was right before the crash.
Yep.
Right. So they started off with some pretty significant losses. In addition to that, we have what I think, and I think most people would agree with this, is just an unrealistic expectation of what the rate of return is going to be. Statutorily, we expect 7.5%, and there's nobody getting 7.5% returns now. And so what has happened as a result of that is that the investment commission, the people who are charged with making our investments, have been trying to reach that 7.5%. Right? Now, it used to be that they could get 3 or 4% from bonds, and then you can get the other 3 or 4% from equities. Mm-hmm. But because of what the federal government has been doing with fiscal policy over the last several years, I mean, everybody knows interest rates are at historical lows, and they have been for a while, which means the bonds aren't paying anything. So if they're going to get a return, it's coming from equities. Well, that's a pretty risky thing to try to have to get 7% just out of the stock market. But they're in a pension system, so they don't want to take risks like that. So they've been paying additional fees because they've basically been buying insurance to hedge some of their investments because of that. And so that has contributed. The other thing is, and this, you know, one of my financial planner friends said just the other day, he said, you know, if you were to come to me and tell me that, you know, you've only been saving a few percentage points of your income, I don't care what we invested in, you're not going to have a very good retirement nest egg, right? And so one of our biggest problems is, quite frankly, we haven't been saving enough, right? We haven't been putting enough in. And we've been asking employees to contribute too much, whereas the employer has not been contributing enough. And after a while, that catches up with you, Ann.
Right.
You know, you're not going to have a successful program if you're not a successful retirement program if you're not saving enough. So lots of those things have contributed. Now, the other thing is what you mentioned about closing the program. The bill that has been introduced right now does not close the program, but I do expect that probably in the next few weeks you're going to see a bill introduced to close the program, close the pension program for future employees. And, you know, for the people who are our current retirees or our current employees who are vested in the system, we can't break that deal that we've made with them.
Sure.
Legally we can't break it, but morally you can't break it. Ethically, sure. You can't break that. I mean, you've promised people you're going to do this. You can't break it. So, but I do think that going forward, we're probably going to have to move, in my opinion, more toward a 401k type program as opposed to the pension system that we've had.
Now, so the effect, though, that I understand is it's going to make city government, county government, the school system, all these people that are part of the state pension system, then it's going to cost more for them for them to be hired because they won't have the pension system to depend on. Is that true?
Well, so there are a couple points about that. The first one is, and this is what a lot of people don't realize, is that most of the people who are in the state retirement system mm-hmm. are not state employees. But most of the people in the state retirement system are school district employees
okay.
or local government employees, county governments or municipal governments.
Okay.
Right? So that's where you're getting most of the people in the system. And those local governments, whether it be school districts or towns or cities or counties, they have not been contributing enough, and the state government hasn't as well for the state employees who are in the system. So that's a long-term thing that we're going to have to deal with. Now, the last thing you mentioned is this going to make them pay more for their employees going forward?
Yeah.
And I do think, look, the pension system is an attractive benefit that is offered to people to sign up for state work.
Sure.
And if you don't have that, then maybe it's not as attractive, so you may have to pay a higher salary for people. That makes sense. Although I will say this, when I was first elected to the Senate and I went in, it was mandatory that I participate in the pension program.
Okay.
I didn't want to participate in the pension program. I was 32 years old. And I was absolutely convinced that I could probably do a better job on my own making decisions for myself than to be part of the pension program, but they wouldn't let me. I think that for younger people, if we give them good 401k options and do some matching programs, which I think we can do pretty creatively, mm-hmm. I think it's a pretty creative option for people that they're not going to have with some private sector jobs. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't pay people. You still ought to pay people what they're worth. And so salary is always an important factor. People got to eat, right? You got to pay the mortgage.
Sure.
So that's important as well. But, yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that we've been hearing about is that if you close that pension program, that's going to make it more difficult to hire or retain state employees. So there's a whole host of issues. This was really like the perfect storm. Lots of things have come together on it. There is no easy fix to it.
Correct. And again, is that an issue that you think that y'all will be able to attack and solve during this session? Because you've also shortened the session this year, right?
That's right. We did. We cut it by, on paper, it's 3 weeks. Effectively, it'll probably be a little bit more than that. But we should be finished with everything. We're supposed to adjourn the second Thursday in May. We typically have to come back for some vetoes, but we should be finished with everything before Memorial Day, which is I think that's a big improvement. It's probably still too long, but it's a big improvement. But I'm optimistic on the pension program too. So the House Ways and Means Committee actually passed out today, I understand, a bill on the pension fix. So that tells me they're taking it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
There's been some discussion in the Senate as well. I think that bill is going to move. That bill right now, if I had to guess, I would say that bill is going to pass before the Rhodes thing will. So I'm optimistic about that as well. And it'll be a good start towards fixing that program.
How do you think the working, this is off the subject, but how do you think the working between the Senate and the House is progressing this year as opposed to last year and some of the rancor stuff that's happened down there? How is it working this year?
I think we're doing much better. And part of that, I hope, is because I have made a very deliberate and conscious effort to talk with the House leadership. Their new majority leader over in the House, Gary Simrell, who's from up in Rock Hill, he and I talk weekly. I talk with the Speaker of the House pretty regularly. We're talking more, and I think that's important. You create the relationship so that it's not acrimonious, because I never really have understood why the Senate Republicans were fighting with the House Republicans all the time.
Sure.
It was always very frustrating to me when the Senate leadership and the House leadership would get in press release fights blaming the other, when I never really cared about any of that. And my observation was that the people in South Carolina didn't care about that either. They saw us all as Republicans. So if we're not getting it, it's all our fault. But I think we've got a much better working relationship now. You know, we still got some ways to go, but we're right now I'm very pleased with the leadership in the House and some of the things they've been able to do. I think we're going to have a good working relationship going forward.
Well, that's great. And of course, you've got a new governor. And how do you think the working relationship between the House, the Senate, and Henry's going to go?
So far, so good. You know, having been lieutenant governor for the last couple of years, Governor McMaster has, you know, been among the Senate, so we all know him pretty well. And in fact, I've met with him two or three times since he's become governor, just so he knows where we are and we know where he is, just to try to have regular conversations. And I think that's important going forward. It's important that, you know, we not get 2 or 3 weeks down the road on something only to realize that he doesn't like it, or vice versa. So I think there's some real opportunities there too. A lot of people are really looking forward to the opportunity because it's something new. But I think there's some real potential there. And I mean, I get along great with Henry, and I think he really wants to do some good stuff. So
good
opportunities.
Absolutely. Well, that's great. Well, listen, this has been great. We haven't gotten together in a good while, and if this is this was great. Thank you so much for calling in. Is there anything you'd like to say to the listeners out there?
No, well, I'd say, you know, thanks for listening and thanks for caring, because you know, too often now it seems like we have people who don't pay attention or don't care. So I appreciate them listening and caring about what's going on. And I just encourage them, look, if you've got ideas about things that we can do to make South Carolina better, let me know. Send me an email, call me. I'd love to hear from you, because I recognize that I don't have all the answers, but I know there's a lot of smart people in South Carolina, and together we can solve some of these problems.
Well, there you go. Thank you very much, Senator Shane Massey. Have a great trip down there to Charleston, and we'll be watching the news to see what happens.
Great, that sounds good. Have me back sometime soon, Ann.
I certainly will. Thank you so much, Shane.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye. Well, that was Senator Shane Massey right here on WCRS. I hope you enjoyed all the different conversations that we got into. We talked about a lot of different topics, and, gosh, I think we at least got a feel on how the Senate, from the Republican side, particularly from the leader of the Republicans, where they stand on this, because he is the Senate Majority Leader. I am going to give it up. I know we only have 8 minutes here, but I'll be back in the morning. So you keep it right here on WCRS. It's going to be a great day tomorrow. And if you haven't been by to see us here at Sharp Facets Gallery, stop on by. We're open till 6 today. That's going to do it for me. Bye-bye, everybody.